Hey, good evening, everybody. I'm Merv. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. Glad to be here tonight. My sobriety date is June 1st, 2001. My home group is the Common Solution Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we have two meetings, 7:30 on Thursday night in Hinton Avenue Methodist Church, and then we have a startup meeting, which is a 9:30 speaker meeting at Grace Community Church. Kind of off near the Bamboo House on Saturday nights at 9:30. I can't remember. The address slipped my mind. But I'm here by the grace of God and the 12 steps. And I'm also here from a lot of pain and somebody carrying a message to me. If I seem a little scatterbrained tonight, today was a little bit of an off-center day. I got a text from my, I guess now, ex-girlfriend, who said that, you know, sometimes I seem a little distant and a little self-absorbed, and I responded by saying, what was that? And, it's like we were chatting outside of the room tonight. It's not alcoholism, it's definitely alcoholism. And a lot of the consequences that I had leading up to my drinking, hopefully you'll identify with, and then my sobriety is mostly just a whole string of getting it wrong, sticking through the process, having become valuable for another alcoholic. Today, I was simply reminded of a couple of things that are important in my life today. One is my relationships with the members of my home group. You know, how tight am I with them? How honest am I with these people? You know, do they know what's going on in my life? You know, and the other one is how often is my hand still sticking out? You know, and I'll tell you what, these things are vital things for a guy like me. You know, I haven't been sober that long, been sober a little bit. But it seems like the longer I stay sober, the more my tendency to get self-absorbed, to be focused on how I feel and how that becomes the most important thing. I'll tell you what, it just happens, and it happens more frequently. And I'm surprised by it sometimes. Like sometimes it'll just sneak up on me, and I can dress it up any way I want. I can dress it up as a work problem, a relationship problem, fear of what my kid thinks of me problem, you name it. And I can dress it up, and it can look like all these problems. But at the end of the day, by me putting my hand out, talking with another alcoholic, whether it's somebody in my home group or the guy who I'll never see again after a meeting, or else if it's a sponsee call-in day like it is today, I'm reminded that I'm not my own primary purpose. I don't have a money problem. I don't have a girlfriend problem. I have a spiritual problem. The book tells me early on that spiritual principles will solve all my problems. And that means that maybe all my problems just might be spiritual. And the thing is, by consistent behaviors in Alcoholics Anonymous, consistent communications, and consistent meeting attendance, I get reminded of that, you know, often. And I need it. Because I'll tell you, you know, I mean, the ego rebuilds itself fast with a guy like me, you know. I still am scared. I'm still selfish. I still can get very self-seeking. And I'll tell you, you know, the fear of what other people think of me can still drive my conduct into the ground, you know. And I wish I was here, and I wish I was the guy who got it right all the time, and I wish I could stand up here and say how my life is mega perfect. But the thing is whenever I go to that jail meeting on Monday night, and I'm full of myself, and all I can see is the negative in my life, I go into that jail meeting, and whenever I come out, I'll tell you what, it's like clockwork. I feel like $1 million. I feel like $1 million. Because I go in there, and I see rightfully where I should be and where I would end up again. You know, and that's why I need those consistent actions in Alcoholics Anonymous. We had a young man speak for us on Saturday night, and he brought up a Malt Duck story, so I'll just go ahead and get started with some drunkalogue for you, so hopefully you'll identify. He brought up a story about how he was driving down the road having some kind of fancy fizzy drink and how it smelled like Malt Duck, and I'll tell you what, it brought back a memory that I almost had forgotten. You know, I don't know if I was born an alcoholic. I don't know if I believe in all that stuff, but I'm going to tell you what, I definitely suffered from an acute, like, absorbed on how I felt. I definitely was one of those kids growing up that, you know, I never felt like a real kind of connection. The only time I felt love for anybody, like, maybe was Christmas morning whenever I got the Tonka truck I wanted all year round, you know. I'd be like, I love you, Dad, you know. And, all right, give me my truck. I'm going to go back up the room, you know, and I'm going to play with my truck. And how you doing today, son, you know. How was your day? Meh. Going to play with my truck, you know. And I'm aware of that because I have a 13-year-old son, you know, and he just wants to play with a laptop. Hey, how was your day at school? He's like, laptop now. And I'm like, okay, you know. And but anyways, you know, and you've heard it a million times in a million stories, you know. I felt a disconnect, and it's easy for me to look back on that today. And, you know, I you know, grew up, and it was kind of odd, you know, but I started having these feelings of difference. But I think what it was just more of like a fear of what other people felt of me, and then what would happen would be this imaginary wall would come up between me and you, because I was already discounting, you know, what you thought of me. And I automatically thought that you saw me as like this poor trailer trash piece of scum. So I wouldn't even let you get close to me to begin with, you know. So there was no interaction with anybody, and there was hardly any interaction with my family. You know, and I must have been selfish and self-involved, because I can remember this at an early age, like how I had already placed the blame for how I felt on other people. You know, I mean, I was a victim at 9, you know. I played that victim card, and I got a lot of miles from it, from mommy and daddy, you know. And, you know, and I'll touch on that a little bit later. But, you know, yeah, I remember growing up and taking nips off of VO bottles because we couldn't afford cough syrup and stuff like that. But with that story I heard on Saturday night, I forgot all about this. But my first drunk, even though it didn't give me the effect that alcohol gives to you know, a hopeless variety of alcoholic, but this is my first drunk. And I'll tell you, and it does have some significance for me. Because looking back on it, you know, I'm self-absorbed. I want to be liked, but I'm too scared to take any actions to be liked. You know, I'm not involved with anybody. And I have three older sisters, and two of them were they're twins, and they're graduating high school. And mom and dad, being good parents that they were, got them a keg, and people could come over for this graduation party, but, you know, people had to hand keys in and all that type of stuff. And they got me an 8-pack of Malt Duck, you know. And I'll tell you, you know, and if you don't know what Malt Duck is, man, it's an appealing beverage for like an 11-year-old kid. You know, I mean, it's grape and it's fizzy and, you know, it's glass bottle, you know, I mean, it was good stuff. So I remember this, you know, and I didn't really have an interest in girls or anything, but I can remember this kind of vaguely, but I remember a moment precisely. And what I do remember is that I'm sitting on this picnic table and I'm drinking these Malt Ducks. And even though I'm not drinking even though I don't remember getting an effect, I'll tell you what, I had the phenomenon of craving from the very first drink. And because I'll tell you what, I drank those Malt Ducks, and what happened was I was sitting there, and there was all the girls from the party on one side of the room and all the guys on the other side of the room or of the yard. And, you know, and they were all the girls were doing their little chatter, and all the guys were like, you know, and this guy rides up on a motorcycle. And his name's Steve. We'll just call him Steve. And he rides up on a motorcycle. He has a leather jacket. He has the tight ripped jeans on. And he, like, comes off, and he has the shades on. And he gets off that bike. And all of a sudden, all the girls, you know, that was it. They focused on him. And all of a sudden, all these guys came up, and they were like his little minions. And they brought him a beer. And he walked up, and he was it. He was the king of the show. And I'll tell you what, I looked at that, and even though I wasn't getting the effect of alcohol, I knew what I wanted to be. I wanted to be the king of the show. You know, that looked awesome, because he was an example of everything that I never thought I would ever have, even at that early age. And, you know, and this is the part I remember, like 100%, clear as a day. I'm sitting on a picnic table. This guy comes up to me, and he taps me on the shoulder, and he's like, hey there. He's like, man, looks like you're drinking like a man. Why don't you come over and hang out with us? And I just remember hammering down those Malt Ducks, and I remember kind of having a good time, but, I mean, it was blackout city. Came coming to the next morning, dying next to the toilet, you know, and my parents just laughing. They're like, he's not going to drink again. And I agreed. I didn't want to drink again, you know. Didn't want any part of it, anything like that at all. And growing up, I mean, I saw examples of all kinds of different types of drinkers, you know. my sisters were all the, you know, I'm going to have one or two and put it down. My one sister, you know, who I thought had a problem, but then she got real drunk, did something embarrassing, hasn't had a drink since, you know. But then I saw my dad, and my dad looked a lot like one of us, you know. I mean, dad was always, you know, getting loaded. And whenever he wasn't getting loaded, he was fighting with mom. And then he'd move out, and then he'd come back. We'd go out for, you know, steaks at a bar, and, you know, at some point I would have to call mom to come pick us up. So he looked a lot like one of us. And mom always called him an alcoholic, too. But growing up, you know, I just didn't want to see this stuff. I didn't want any part of it. I just wanted to play baseball and be by myself. You know, Merv's little world, you know. And in a little fantasy world, you know, which pretty much consists out of Cheryl Teagues and everybody else in the world dying and us at a camp up on top of the mountain, you know. Yeah, I just lived there, man. Me and Cheryl Teagues just chilling out, you know, in the bunker. You know, that was a, wow, whoa, that was a, might have to revisit that one tonight, you know. And, so, anyways, I watched, up until this point, I watched two of my grandparents drink themselves to death. My mom's dad, the only time I met him face to face was the day before he died in the hospital. And I watched, that was my dad's dad. And then I watched my mom's mom, you know, basically drink herself to death. And so Grandpa had to move in. He already had liver disease, and he was in bad shape. And this is the chronic alcoholic that I saw. And it's also like, man, I didn't want any part of it. Part of Mom's idea of how to get him to control and enjoy his drinking was to send me with him. You know, and if you've never been to like a honky-tonk in Pennsylvania, I mean, there's no windows. You know, they open at 10 a.m. And, you know, so, you know, before and after or in the middle of baseball practices, I'd be in the car with Grandpa, and they were adventurous car rides. And we'd go rolling in. And I'll never forget it, like Saturday morning, you know. I witnessed this before I ever had it, which is we went to this honky-tonk bar, and we walk in, and A, it's early, you know, and it's dark. And I'm like, what's going on? And I go in, and, you know, there's this woman named Joanne C. She has passed from alcohol. She has died a horrible alcoholic death. But she was the first one I saw that needed to, you know, basically get those first couple down and hold her hand steady. She's sitting across from us. There's a big glass mirror. Everybody's just looking down. Nobody's looking at the mirror or each other or nothing. And I'm just like, whoa, what's this? You know, why am I here? But I'll tell you what, it was like clockwork. And I've sat through this and I've seen it, you know, as a kid several times. Like, as soon as they were able to choke down those first four or five, something would happen. And what would happen is that community, they would have their own, like, you know, communal kind of, try to cheer each other up. Somebody put a quarter in a jukebox. You'd hear the pool balls break, and then there'd be this camaraderie, and it was like they were changing before my eyes. And I was like, and I saw this, and it was like, man, shoot me if I ever turn into something like this. And I'll tell you what, that was the effect. You could just see it looking back on the elusive, how they were trying to recapture something from their past, that alcohol probably stopped working them for years ago like it did for me. And, I mean, it was a horror show, you know, and whenever I got my first drink, my first effect that alcohol would produce was all my sisters are off now, they're all gone, college, everything like that. I'm 15, I'm still overweight, I still have no friends, I have one, and I don't want any part of anybody, you know. And we go to this bar, and they're like, hey, drive us this bar, Grandpa just died, watch him drink himself to death. I'll go, but, you know, I don't want to be there all night. And they were like, hey, no problem. So we go to the bar, three older sisters. It's like clockwork. What do you want? What do you want? They order their drinks. And then they look at me. And this bartender, she asked me, like, what do you want? And a double Jim Beam and Coke just came out of my mouth. And it's just like it happened. You know, we all have had that moment, like, where it happened. And I'll tell you what had happened. Man, I had a couple of those things in me. And all of a sudden, man, my sisters seemed like the most interesting people in the world. Like, I wanted to talk to them, and I wanted to, like, be a part of them. Like, it was like this new feeling, like, where everybody wasn't as scary. All of a sudden, all that stuff, that cloud that I seemed to have been under, seemed to evaporate. And this is the part that kicked it off, was I think I laughed for real for the first time. Like, man, it was on. You know, and I heard a speaker one time, you know, say that, you know, the first time you feel that feeling, it's like hitting a bullseye. And then we're chasing that bullseye from that point on. And I'll tell you what, I chased that moment forever. You know, back in those early days, I'm going to tell you, you know, I had thoughts of suicide from the age of eight on. And I'll tell you, whenever I found the magic of alcohol, man, there was no more thinking about killing myself. You know, I found something. And what alcohol did for this secluded kid was, it made me come out and play. I wasn't as scared of what you thought of me, and I was able to engage. And I'll tell you, I had what everybody wanted, which was a lot of booze, because I was the one getting served. So here I am. I'm on my way to Steve C., and I achieved it. By the time I was a senior, what alcohol did for me was I was dating a prom queen. I was president of my class, and I was voted most likely to succeed. And that's what alcohol did for me. And that would be the illusion that I would chase to almost the grave for many years later. And a lot of my drunk log is I drank myself out. I traded everything I had in my life for booze. College education went away. You know, relationships, tight relationships with friends that I thought were tight, they all went away, you know. And mostly it was a byproduct of the conduct that I had. You know, I mean, I moved up and down the East Coast, you know. I didn't really land in Charlottesville until I was about 24. I spent a lot of time in New York, and I had to leave. I basically got drunk and, you know, hit on a priest, like, 16-year-old sister, you know, and got chased out of, I mean, I had to leave New York. I had to go. At 21, I opened up a bar in Savannah, Georgia, and I'll tell you, the achievement that actually was to open the first punk club in a city of that, like that. You know, I mean, I traded everything in for that too, you know, and I had this long string of moving around, and you guys know the story, wherever I went, there I was, you know, and I would always have this imaginary thing like, this is going to be the new start, this is going to be the time where Merv can, I'm going to pull my britches up and I'm going to act right, but the whole thing is sooner or later, whenever I'm drinking, all of a sudden, man, there's a bad idea, it passes through my head. And it doesn't look like a bad idea at all. It looks like the next right thing, you know. and you know, we're all about the next right thing, aren't we? You know, and that's what I was all about. And so I landed in Charlottesville, and you know, and at this point in time, alcohol, you know, was starting to pay a price. You know, at this point, I've already had like 700 drinking fines, a couple of DUIs, and you know, and I got to watch my dad, something profound happen. You know, and I would hold on to this too, is that they found a spot on his liver, and he had his first grandbaby, and he stopped drinking, you know, years ago, and he didn't go to church, didn't go to a shrink, didn't go to AA, didn't do nothing, just stopped drinking, and after he actually got rid of the DTs because he was physically addicted to alcohol, which does not make you an alcoholic. He straightened up and he led a happy, productive life. He was able to achieve happy and sober without any, you know, spiritual experience and without really any human power aid beside his own will. And, you know, I always thought that he was an alcoholic, and I would chase that maybe, you know, the answer to my problem would always be right living and straightening up just like my dad, but I'm a hopeless alcoholic, so I could never achieve that. But it wasn't for a lack of trying. You know, so I saw that, and it was like, okay, now, you know, my life is starting to get, you know, there was a lot of fun, but there's problems and fun. I'm on the tail ends of problem and fun right about now. And if dad can stop and be happy and sober, I can stop and I can be happy and sober. And I didn't realize that the book describes him, and he's not a hopeless alcoholic. He's just a heavy drinker. You know, and a lot of those people die before their time. They look a lot like us, but, you know, and he has some of those guys floating around in there too, you know, and, but, you know, I held on to that. I put that away in the old keen alcoholic mind, and that would be something I'd bring back up many times. You know, and, you know, so essentially what ended up happening was I realized that I needed a girlfriend, I needed to settle down, I needed to get a real job, I needed to finish up my college education. These were all things that were going to basically start to fix me. Because I already knew at this point, long before I stepped one foot in AA, that once I started drinking, man, all bets were off. And I'll tell you, I knew that. Because, man, I was crazy, you know, and I saw her. She was my cocktail waitress, and, you know, and it was love at first sight, you know, and looking back on it, I knew, you know, it was also she can fix me at first sight. I thought, you know, here is this person who is a college graduate, first chair violinist, you know, she had everything going for her in her life. If I can just get mixed up with that type of person, maybe I can straighten out. And plus, she's awesome. You know, she's beautiful. And our first date, I took her down to Smith Mountain Lake. I took my whole bar staff, made it look good. She's out, like, water skiing and jet skiing and doing all this stuff. And I strategically had a half of a rolling rock that I let get warm. Had it right here. Just, that's my beer. Oh, it's warm. You know, because I don't want her to know what a loser I am. And I don't want her to know just how bad I get when I start drinking. So, man, the masquerade was on, and the show was on, and I tried my best to put it on. But I'll tell you what, every time she left that dock on a pair of skis and hit the water, man, I'm going to tell you what, I'm scared to death of what she's thinking of me. Am I a loser? Man, you know, I really like her. So what's my answer to fear? What's my answer to uncomfortability? It's reaching in that cooler and pulling out that bottle of Jaeger, man, and slugging that thing and hitting that thing. And I hit it, you know, and finally it's my turn to get on the jet ski. And me and one of my best buds, we went out, one of my bartenders, we went out and I fell off and he didn't know where I was. And where I popped my head up, he hit me going 55 with the jet ski. And, you know, I've heard many different stories how all that went down. All I know for certain is whenever I regained consciousness 30 days later down in the hospital in Roanoke, that girl on our first date, she was there. And, you know, and I opened my eyes, and whenever I saw her, you know, I just, you know, I didn't say anything. All I said was, I have to stop drinking. That's what I said. Those were my first words coming out to her. And, you know, and she was just like, look, you know, whenever you just need to take it easy, you know, and whenever you get out, you know, maybe we can find you some kind of help. And, you know, so I was in the hospital, had, you know, crazy surgeries done. And whenever I got out, you know, I mean, you know, it wasn't 2 days later that, you know, I mean, I'm still in liquor out of somebody's liquor cabinet and I don't know what I'm doing. You know, I don't know what I'm doing. Why am I doing this? I mean, it's easy for me to look back. You know, I suffer from this illness. You know, once I start, I can't stop. But the really puzzling piece for us is why we can't stay stopped. You know, and that was always a puzzling thing for me. You know, looking back on this simple nature is I have this obsession that I cannot leave it alone, but simply to make it dummy it down for a guy like me is I can't stand how I feel sober. And it gets so bad that I have to treat that. And I've tried to treat it a lot of ways. I mean, up on the top of the mountain over there on 33, you know, after, you know, years and years of trying to control and enjoy my drinking, the madness. You know, it brought me into AA. I got two more DUIs, and one of those DUIs, I'm going to tell you what, I was on a run. I got one, and, man, oh, my God, I got one in Winchester, and I was trying to get my parents, save my parents, even though I'm still a victim. If they would have raised me right, I wouldn't be like this. And I'm on my way up to, you know, basically a tree fell on my parents' trailer, and they have no money. They need some help, and I'm running up there because I really want to be a son. I really want to give back, you know, in my heart I do, you know, but I don't have that capability because, I mean, I'm drinking and I get pulled in Winchester, you know, with like two cases of like some crappy beer, get a DUI and I get out of the drunk tank and I know I can't go back home. I know I can't because she's ready to leave and I go back up to Pennsylvania. I'm no absolute good. I go on a bender of all benders up there. I get another DUI in Pennsylvania four days later. And I mean, I'm losing my mind and I'm looking for it. I'm back in the town. I'm sitting in the bar where my grandfather took me and I can't look at myself in that mirror. And I don't know why this thing, this magic of alcohol is not giving me what it gave to me anymore. And I, you know, after that run, I came back and whenever I came back, this is the scariest moment. I have the guts to finally come back. She knows what's going on. She's like, I don't know what you're going to come back to. I go up to the lane of my house, and there's a hearse there. They had the wrong address. But I'm going to tell you what. Dude, when you're pulling in after a bender like that, and you're, like, just drinking to stay sane, to be able to drive. I had to drink to be able to drive. And I pull in, and there's a hearse at my house. And, I mean, at this point, I'm gone. I lost it. I went right up to him. I said, who are you here for? Who are you here for? And I was waiting. I thought it was dead. I mean, I was nuts. I was like in this crazy land. And they're like, is this so-and-so, so-and-so? And I'm like, no, you know. And I was like, wow, okay, that's two houses down. And but, man, you know, and so at this point in time, I've been spending a lot of time coming in and out of rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And, you know, I had a good idea what was coming. You know, I heard the steps being talked about. Everybody kept welcoming me back. But, you know, for a lot of purposes or a lot of different reasons, I didn't think I was exactly like you people. I've seen a bunch of shrinks. I saw a shrink about being, you know, if mom and dad would have treated me better or raised me better. And this shrink, you'll love this. He looked at me straight in the eye and he pinpointed my problems back to when mom and dad didn't give me a Darth Vader Pez dispenser when I was 12. That's why you're messed up. And I looked at him, I said, man, I'm going to pay you. You know, you're my kind of shrink, man. I like you, you know. Dude, I mean, anybody that's going to feed into my victimization, man, that's my kind of guy, you know. He's my friend, you know. And but, you know, so I'm seeking all these other things. I have, at this point in time, 5 different diagnoses. You know, so, you know, we talk about Ann DePanda's an alcoholic. And if you are, you know, that's fine. But for me, I was walking in here. There was no way. You guys are alcoholics. You guys are happy and sober. You guys are laughing. And I'm always in here on the end of a run or she's going to leave. And I'm coming in here and I'm just not drinking. And I come in here and you guys are suffering from alcoholism. And I'm alcoholic and an addict and a marijuana addict and a sex addict. And hanging out with Cheryl T's my head addict and, you know, I mean, all this stuff, you know, and I just never felt like I was like, just, you know, I didn't, I'm glad you guys are okay, but man, I'm much more affected than you are. And, so it didn't really seem right, you know, and plus I wasn't willing to give it up. There was always the I can get there again mentality, the illusion that somehow someday I'll be able to control and enjoy my drinking was still there because I had the thought of my dad in the back of my head. I was still like wanted to be Steve C. I thought I could be him again. I could get back to those days. And, you know, and the wife then, she was done. You're out. And I always used to, I had this big old thing like she left, but really, no, I incrementally pushed her away, you know, because once again, I need to trade something in because I want to drink the way I want to drink. And even if that's the love of my life, that's what I'm going to do. Because that's how powerless I really truly am. And so at this point, I'm like out of inpatient treatment, drinking, I mean, going to meetings, drinking, you know, I mean, it was crazy. No license, no job. And you know, and there's people in there, you know, and I heard this person say, you know, you never have to drink again if you do certain things, you know. And of course, it's a member of AA that I hate, you know, because they're talking about doing all the things I'm not doing, you know, like, you know, sponsorship and home group and getting active here, you know, all those things I'm not doing, you know. So, of course, I, like, dislike this person immensely, you know. And, you know, but I got out of jail 2 times in 3 days, and something happened. Something happened. You know, they say the first step of recovery is conceding to their innermost self that we're alcoholic. And I'll tell you what, I mean, I don't know what that looks like, but I sure know how it feels. And whenever I got out of jail that last time and, you know, the jig was up. You know, I stopped at a convenience store on the walk back from jail into Charlottesville and I tried to get a 22 Bud Light down my system just to keep me from, like, losing my mind, and I couldn't keep it down. And there was a payphone there. You know, and I wanted to make a call. I didn't have a quarter, so I hiked the whole way back to my place, and I got out my big book, and there was a number of the person that said, you never have to drink again, and I called that person up. And here's a person, and this is, a lot of people say I'm a big book guy, I'm a home group guy. If I'm anything, I like to think that I'm a primary purpose guy, because this is the first example of the power of God through the members of Alcoholics Anonymous that I saw. And whenever I witnessed this, didn't know it at the time, but now, man, it's crystal clear. You know, here's a person that was going to go to an AA conference, you know, and basically go on vacation after that. And what they did was they said, look, if you really want to talk, go to that 5:30 AA meeting and I'll pick you up after. And what they did was they put their whole life on hold. And they took me in their home and they started talking about alcoholism. And I'm like, yeah. I know all about once I start, I can't stop. I got the first step. And they're like, nah. And they started talking more. And the thing that got me was this. I mean, you know, the hook, I mean, I was already beaten, you know. I mean, I was tired. But I don't know, you know, just like any tired fish, man, they had to put the hook in the mouth, and this was it. When they started talking about untreated alcoholism and what that looked like, man, I could relate across the board. When they started talking about how just not drinking is not a solution to what we have, that how actually drinking is a solution for that uncomfortable feeling I get sober, man, I understood that. Because, man, all of a sudden I'm Rolodexing back, you know. They're sharing their experience, and I'm thinking about, like, just waiting for the wife to go to bed. Just waiting for her to go to bed. And then she'd go down the hallway, you know, and I'd just, like, keep looking, you know. And then the light would go out. and it was just like leaving Las Vegas, man, in the liquor store and see, man, I was feeling like $1 million. And the best feeling I would ever get was to walk back to the trunk to make myself a big old Listerine vodka Zima. You know, I had this big pitcher, and I had more satisfaction and more levity walking to make it than I actually ever got from it. And I would just sit back there by my car, and I just chug these things down. And they're telling me their experiences like that, too. And they were like, well, why did you do that? You're burning your life to the ground, but why does alcohol always look like an answer to anyway? And I said, because I can't stand how I feel. And they were like, that's it. That's the puzzling piece of what we have. See, you're not a problem drinker. You're an alcoholic. And we read, and I told, and I shared about my dad, and they're like, your dad's in the book, but he's not an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. You're this guy. And I was like, oh, man. And the thing is whenever I identified on that level, they asked me a couple of things, and singleness of purpose is just as important as the first step for a guy like me. They said, look, Merv, we know that you have a lot of problems. We know you've been coming in and out of here. We're glad to see you here alive. But the thing is, what we've got to ask you to do here is that we've got to ask you just to be an alcoholic and Alcoholics Anonymous. If you can set aside all those other problems, and they are problems. And then they showed me that part, like how spiritual principles could solve all my problems. They were like, well, let's just concentrate on the big king alcohol, and we're going to work the steps, and I bet you everything else clears up. And I'll tell you what, that was a saving grace. Now all of a sudden, all I have to do is worry about this one thing, and then the treatment for it's outlined in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And and I'll tell you what, you know, I had a vigor about going through the steps. I mean, I was enthusiastic. I came to believe that Alcoholics Anonymous could help me with my drinking. I also came to believe that Alcoholics Anonymous could help me stay sober from my drinking. And I started working the steps the best I could. You know, I mean, I dug my heels in a lot along the way. You know, I mean, I wasn't like, you know, a poster child for AA, you know, like the guys that I wish I would get, you know. But, man, I'll tell you, you know, I get who I was, you know. Oh, there's this four-step coming, you know, and you can just see the look in their eyes because all they're doing is Rolodexing back to the horror show, you know. And I remember the horror show, you know. I mean, I know what it's like not to look at yourself in the mirror. I know what it's like not to drink and have the memories of, like, you know, just horror show stuff, you know, things you've done, and it's just creeping, and it's on you all the time, and you got to treat that stuff. You know, I know what that's like. But the thing was, is that first day, you know, of sobriety, when I'm sitting at that kitchen table, they made me a promise. They said, Merv, if you stay here and you get active here and you take these items through the step process, it is not garbage. What this thing is going to do is it's going to recycle it into being useful. And the book tells you that this will be your greatest asset. So whatever happens to you, you know, it's never bad. It's never garbage. It's up to you to take the actions here to make sure that it's always used for the other alcoholic. And I'll tell you what, that's just as true as it was then as it is for me now. And I'll touch on that a little bit later. But I believe them, and I believe them. You know, and I knew I was as sick as my secrets, and I had a bunch of them. Of course, I'm, like, unique, you know. And I had this, like, guy who was trying to be my sponsor. He was up in northern Jersey. I'm down in Charlottesville. I drive up to Dulles Airport. He flies down. I fifth step in the chapel closet in Dulles Airport. And I came clean, you know, all that stuff. I mean, I never, ever wanted to share, you know, and I just wanted to be general about it, you know. But, I mean, there was some doozies. And it turned out that they weren't as big of a deal as I thought they were. Because as I'm sharing, it was just like it was like clockwork. This gentleman just started sharing. He's like, yeah, man, I've done that. And then he'd say something back to me, and I'd be like, and then I didn't feel like, I was like, well, I got that out. He did that. And then I got to tell him about prom night. And then I got to tell him about, you know, the priest's sister, you know, and I got to tell him about some stuff that went down, you know, at the house, you know, that violence that I wasn't proud of. And he was like, man, you're just like me. You're just like me. And, you know, the fifth step promises are great stuff. You know, I remember taking a whiz after the fifth step, and I'm like, I'm waiting for, like, you know, rainbows and ponies, but I didn't have rainbows and ponies. I didn't feel too good. But the thing is, like, years later, whenever I chatted with this guy again, he was just like, nah, dude, I saw you change right before my eyes. I saw you. And I don't remember what that felt like. I don't remember going through that, but I'll tell you what, I know what it looks like. Because, man, you get those sick guys in your car, man. You just see them holding on. They're holding on that last one, and then you see it, you know, and it, something magic happens. And I swear, you know, I miss my ball, though, because I've heard so many fifth steps in that car. And I'll tell you, man, that was magic. That was magic, just to be able to see people change. Like, and it was amazing. And, you know, so, I mean, I came clean, and I went out, and I started trying my best to start making amends. And, you know, it's my first Christmas in sobriety, and I got money in my pocket a little bit. I got a job, you know. You want to talk about an ego blow. I got my first day of sobriety, I got fired from a law firm. You know, my first job in sobriety was washing dishes for a Greek diner. Yeah. And I tell you what, you want to grow spiritually, work for some Greeks in a diner, you know. And, you know, they never called me Merv. It was just Malacca all the time, you know. And I love those guys. And, man, they were great to me. And, you know, so I went back home and I had some cash and I'm like, went to my sponsor. I'm like, I'm ready to pay back for the porn that I stole, you know? And he's just like, yeah, I'm sure you are, you know? And, he's just like, look, you're going back up and you haven't seen your family. And what you need to do is you need to get up there and you need to get straight. And, he's like, look, you can pay for the porn, but what I want you to do is you need to spend some time with your family. Why don't you go up there and be a son on Christmas? You can make the amends, but, man, if it gets a little too hairy and they don't want to do it, don't force it. So I went up there, and I just talked to each of them individually. My three sisters, I mean, left me off the hook. Just keep doing what you're doing. You know, Dad, you know, my dad experience was profound. It was very quick, you know, but the mom experience was extraordinary. You know, when we carry this message by practicing the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, sometimes it's just not my business, you know. And sometimes whenever I'm doing these things like making amends and I'm paying back for the porn or I'm paying back Kmart for this or I'm paying back, you know, Ruby Tuesdays for all the money I stole from them, you know, I don't see the impact that that's actually making, because what I'm doing is I'm giving them a good idea of what Alcoholics Anonymous is really all about, you know. And I've had experiences on the other end of the paying back meaningless you know, amends, like where they've actually confided in me that they have somebody, does AA really work? And I'm like, yeah, it really works. But you got to come here, you know, in a pretty bad state, you know, sometimes. But, you know, I've had a lot of experiences like that. But really, the amends experience, especially for those people close to me, you know, because I am a wrecking ball, I'm selfish and I'm self-centered, you know, and I do, like, you know, I mean, I use people up and I toss them away, you know, and that's always been my MO. And, whenever I went back, you know, it was just like I went back to mom and I just said, look, you know, I'm a crappy kid. And I was a crappy kid. You know, I didn't show up. You know, I didn't mow the yard. I didn't do the things you asked me to do. And she looked at me and she said, Merv, if I would have raised you better, maybe you wouldn't have turned out like this. You know, I told her that so many times that she believed it. And, you know, I was, mom, again, in the hospital today, fell down and broke her leg and her wrist in the same spot. And, and I'm looking at this woman, and I said, Mom, you did the best you could with what you had. In fact, you did a great job. I said, that was just a bunch of BS I was feeding you because I was just sick and I was a bad kid. And I don't want to be that kid no more, you know. And I said, you know, and we talked about how we could get the slate clean between us. And she was like, you know, please make the phone calls. You know, please do this. I want to know you. I haven't seen you or heard from you in years. I just want to get to know my son. And I did, you know, I didn't, you know, and, you know, I think the amends process is key. The face-to-face amends, but I'm going to tell you what, if I'm willing to go back and make the amends, I better be willing to take the actions that are going to come after. You know, because I think the amends are a great thing, but I'll tell you what, I think the real amends happens after the initial, you know, contact and the talk. The true amends for me were all the phone calls that I made to mom and dad, you know, every Monday and every Tuesday, you know, getting all the cards, you know, whenever they needed help, actually getting up there, not drunk, you know, and actually getting up there and actually being of service. And the magic thing happened. The magic thing was she became a mom again, you know, and I let her do that. And the same way with my dad, you know, I miss my dad. My dad passed, New Year's Eve this year. And I miss him a lot. I talk to him every Monday. And, you know, and, man, I do miss him. But I know that, you know, for the time that he was here and the time that I've been sober, you know, whenever I made those phone calls. And I'll tell you, man, all he ever wanted to be was a dad. And I know the feeling when you have a 13-year-old son. All I want to do is just be a dad. And I'll tell you, you know, the great thing was that I left him be a dad. Those were his happiest moments. He's dying from cancer. And he's still taking care of my mom, who can't get out of bed. And he sounds drowned when he gets on the phone. And all of a sudden, I have, like, some stupid problem. You know, I'll just bring it up. Some of them were fake and some were real. They're like, hey, you know what? You know, Jack's been, you know, a little distant. You know, what's that all about? What do you think? Man, damn. It was like the fire came on him. He sounded healthy. He'd be like, yeah, that's just the way kids are. He's like, hey, let me give you some suggestions. And he would feel all right, and he would be in tune, and we'd be connected. And that's what he wanted most of all in his missing years. And I'm glad I was able to give that back to him. I'm glad I was able to tell him that I loved him from the bottom of my heart. And I was also glad that I can see where he was trying to be the best example of manhood that I could ever see. And he gave me a great example. So whenever the day came and I had to go up and, you know, it was my decision, you know, and he's dying, he's unconscious. Do we let him live for 30 days, 60 days on a machine, unconscious? And I said, you know what, he's been a man all his life. Let's let him go out like one, you know. And I couldn't have made that decision without the guys in my home group and my sponsor. They said, Merv, just because he's passing on doesn't mean you stop being a son. You got to be a son now, and now is probably the most important time to be that son. And I had to make that decision. It was the hardest decision of my life. But I'll tell you what, I couldn't see that man suffer. Not in that weakened state. Because I like to keep my memory of him, the strong man that he was. And today, you know, I know he's a piece of me. He's a piece of my son. You know, and I still have talks with him. And I have talks with God. And I'll tell you, you know, I couldn't have reached that point without the immense process of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's so many people that short themselves. They come in here, they're three now. Or maybe they're going to get to four. And maybe they'll cough up half the secrets. And God knows I've worked with many of them. You know. But the end result is always the same. If they're a chronic alcoholic of my type, half measures will avail you nothing. You know. And it's unfortunate, you know, because alcohol had to answer every question I had about my illness. And then sometimes they have to go back out and alcohol answer their question too. See, I can't get nobody sober here, and I can't get anybody drunk, but that doesn't mean I can't tell them the truth. And I'll tell you, you know, I'm glad I had people in my life that weren't afraid to tell me the truth, you know, because I'll tell you, you know, without that, you know, man, I start making up lies in sobriety, and I start believing them, you know, left unchecked. Rest of the steps, I think, for me, you know, are good things. I wish I practiced them more. Pausing when agitated and doubtful, you know, I mean, I wish I could do that more often. I'm better than I've ever been, you know. I practice the principles in my relationships and at work better than I've ever been. You know, but I'll tell you what, you know, we were joking before the morning or before the meeting, and it, you know, it's not alcoholism, it's alcoholism. And it, just because I don't have a drink doesn't mean that my illness isn't progressing, because I'm going to tell you, man, oh, wow. Man, I can fall like right in loops and bouts of self-pity like today, like just like, my God, you know. What's up, you know, and I'll tell you, you know, I'm glad I have a sponsor, you know, and it's just like I shared at the beginning of the meeting. I need a constant reminder that I don't have a girlfriend problem. I don't have a family problem. I don't have a relationship problem. What I have is a spiritual problem, and the solution is always the same. It's getting out of self by getting, you know, trying to turn my thoughts and then actually go out and try and do something for somebody else, preferably an alcoholic. And I'll tell you, man, I mean, I need to do that stuff consistently in my life, because what happens is the principles I get to practice in kindergarten here and in my home group, when all of a sudden everybody's fighting about how much money we spend on donuts, you know, it's those little things that I practice in my home group meetings and in my relationships within my home group, because, man, we're all alcoholic. I mean, it gets a little weird sometimes. But by practicing those things, what happens is slowly they start to leak out into my relationships out there. You know, and I, and that's why I need to be consistent in my home group, you know. I used to be the grumpy old home group guy at like 7 years sober. I'm glad I'm not that guy anymore, you know. I get to let those guys make their decision. Me and one of my best friends, we started a meeting in Charlottesville, and it was just us two, and then we had three for like 4 years. Nobody was coming to our group. You know, today we have like 20 to 25 home group members. You know, we're active. We do day conferences. We do everything together. You know, and I think, you know, I mean, trying to get to the 12th step here, you know, which is basically for me, you know, the carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll tell you what, man, the herd mentality. I still believe to this day that a group can carry a much stronger message than any individual person, and it's my job to be a part of that group and just put in my 2 cents whenever I'm asked to. reach out whenever, you know, be an example for those new guys when I have to. You know, do these things, and it's not because I have to, but it's because that's what I'm really here to do. And the thing is just like what will happen is I see it all the time, man. You just get one of these guys in the middle of this big school of fish, man, and they just move around. It turns into like one big entity, you know. And I've also seen the little stray fish off to the side get a little squirrely and get nailed. You know, I've seen that too. You know, so that's part of my job today, you know. Stay current with my sponsor, stay current with my home group, stay in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Most importantly, pick up the phone and keep working with others. And working with others is a big deal because I am here to tell you, and this is not podium flash, the horror story that I've walked in here with all those dastardly deeds and everything I've done, you know, drunk and sober, you know, has been useful for another alcoholic. You know, I mean, for me, you know, I think the ninth step is very free, you know, and if you're looking back at the old channel analogy, you know, I'll tell you, man, you know, if power's flowing in, you know, I'll tell you what, if you want to chip away at that stone, the package deal 4-9 will take care of that. But, I mean, if it can flow in but it could stay stagnant, it needs a way to pass out. And the way it's going to pass out for me is working with other alcoholics, the primary purpose. And then that channel stays clear. It gets muddied up, trust me. There's a lot of maintenance to keep those channels clear. But, you know, for me, whenever I find myself in that right spot at that right time, and I don't want to be there, but that guy has my attention. And all of a sudden, I see a little bit of myself in that guy. And I'll tell you what, man, it takes me right back. I know exactly where I came from. You know, I know exactly. You know, because I'll tell you, you know, I've seen it. You know, resentment may be the number one manifestation of self. You know, but I'll tell you what, you know, inconsistent behaviors in Alcoholics Anonymous is the number one factor in getting drunk. You know, and I've seen it all the time. You hear the stories. People just, like, lessen up their meetings. All of a sudden, the job, the kids, everything else becomes more important. You know, and unfortunately, I've had to see people close to me go through that. And I've seen people do it successfully and use Alcoholics Anonymous, up their meetings when they have no time at all and be able to pass through these things with grace and dignity that I'll tell you what, man, I can't see that. I don't know how they do it, but I'll tell you what, just knowing that they've done it gives me hope that if anything comes down my path like that, all I have to do is just go to them and they'll tell me how to do it. And the answer is always the same, you know. Early on, my sponsor said the equation goes like this, Murr. If you think you have a money problem, what I want you to do is I want you to go to the meeting a half hour early, set up some chairs, try and talk to some alcoholics, share if you want, and then stay a little bit late, you know, put away some chairs, and then give somebody a ride home. Do that every day, and then tell me, you know, I'll give you a week, and then tell me how it goes. You know, and I call them back the next week, and I'll be like, man, everything's all right. I was just making a big deal about all that. Then I call them up 2 weeks later. You know, oh, the roof caved in. My check didn't, you know, clear. And he's like, hey, I got an idea. I want you to go to a meeting, get there a half hour early, you know, set up some chairs, shake some hands, stay late, shake some more hands, give somebody a ride, do that every night for a week, and then call me back next week. Man, I'm like an idiot. You know, I didn't even realize what was going on for 5 years, and I was like, oh, okay. But the solution here is always the same, you know. So whatever does come down, you know, like, you know, just some wacky behaviors around the house, you know, I mean, just, you know, sobriety issues, man. I haven't behaved great in sobriety, you know. I mean, I've broken hearts in sobriety, you know. I've stolen in sobriety. I mean, I have tons of imperfections. But the thing is like what I found here is that if you get somebody that you're sharing with or you're hearing somebody share about how they get it all, how they get it right all the time, I'm like, nah, I don't even listen to that guy. Man, what gets my attention is somebody just, like, went through living hell, like lost a child or something just and miserable. I mean, crazy stuff. And then how they, you know, they contacted their higher power through the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and God pulled up their britches and dusted him off and sent him back out to the firing lines of life. Those are the stories I need to hear because I'll tell you what, I don't get it right and I don't think I ever will, but it's better than it's ever been. And I'll tell you what, as long as I stay close to the members of Alcoholics Anonymous and the good examples that you guys show me how to practice these principles instead of tell me how to find them in a dictionary, but actually show me, man, you know what? I have a lot of hope for my future. It's been really great to be here tonight. I want to thank you all for coming out. Thanks for having me, Billy. Yeah.